When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
The sound of the funeral bell, for many of us, merits no more than a momentary thought. That is, of course, unless the bell is associated with the death of a relative or friend. The census figures indicate that about 33,000 people are put under the clay every year in the Republic. But there are no figures available that reveal the number of people left behind by those who died, and who are deeply affected emotionally and perhaps financially, because a close relative or friend has passed on. At a guess, it would be safe to say that an average of three people are greatly saddened by any one person's death. So about 100,000 people are bereaved annually in the 26 counties. Up to 70 or 80 years ago, most children could expect to lose a brother or sister at some time. But nowadays, it is quite common for a person to reach middle age without ever having been close to someone who has died. Yet, whenever the death of someone we love occurs, it's as if our whole world has been turned upside down, and for a while we lose our bearings, because grief is the price we pay for love. It's the cost of commitment. The loss and deprivation caused by bereavement vary from person to person, depending on different circumstances. Yet experts tell us that grief does follow a fairly standard pattern. And in this program, we'll hear how some people reacted to the crisis of bereavement. Margaret was a young married woman with a family. One evening, she was out walking with her husband, and he said he didn't feel too good. And when they came home, he lay on the bed for a while.
I gave him his cup of tea and two Aspros, and that was about 6:30 on a Sunday night, which Sunday it was. And then I went to put one of the little fellas to bed. Donald was three. I carried him up the stairs and I knew my husband was dead. He had a heart attack. I didn't know at the time it was a heart attack, but his eyes was gone and the book was on his chest. So I ran out in the street looking for a priest or a doctor on a Sunday and I couldn't get one. And my brother-in-law seemed to just be visiting me and he ran up to Danny to try and do something for him, but he couldn't. And when I went to get the doctor said I'd have to get the police in. You see, they couldn't move him or anything like that. Of course, when I got the death certificate too, he was coronation posts. That was my first, thing. So at that time, I nearly lost my reason. I left my home. I gave up my house in Whitehall, and I moved down. But it didn't work out down to my mummy. So I stuck that for a few years with the four little children. I worked and everything like that, and then I met my second husband. And we came up here, and we lived up here.
And if Margaret's description of the loss of her husband seems matter-of-fact now, that's because another blow was to come that dulled her earlier memories.
So anyway, I got on up here now. It wasn't too bad. And the children were going to school. I had three more children. That was seven children I had here. Now, I sent my son down there to St. David's, and he was a very good boy. And I reared him till he was 20 years of age, and he got a job in telecommunications. And he was doing very well, and he was down the country all the time, and he only came up for weekends. So Whit weekend in 1975, he came up on a Friday night and he babysit for him and I to go out. On Saturday night, he got ready to go out. He went down to his girlfriend's for his tea. That was about 6:00. He left the house. quit Saturday. And he used to bring us in fish and chips and a bottle of lemonade every Saturday night. That was our treat from him. And I waited here till about 12:30, and I said to my husband, I said, "Oh, look, I'm not waiting anymore, I'm going up to bed." So we went up to bed, and I must have went to sleep, but I heard terrible noises and talk and men's voices, and I jumped out of bed and looked out the window, and here I see the squad car with the police outside, and I knew there was something wrong. And I had another boy out as well. The other fellow was out too at a dance. And I thought maybe they were in a fight. Naturally, like with boys, that was when I saw the police and everything around. And I got up and I ran down the stairs, and my other son, he was only 17, he was in the hall with something behind his back. And I said, what's wrong? He was terrible white. I said, "What's wrong with you?" And I said, "Where's my other fellow?" And I said, "Where's Paul?" And he said, "Mommy, there's something wrong with him. He met in an accident." And I said, "What's that behind your back?" And it was his shoe. And it was all bits, his new shoe. And my husband and Don went in the, what do you call it, in the squad car to the Mater Hospital. Now, I only thought he was hurt. I didn't know he was gone. And that was 5 o'clock in the morning. So I lay there in that sofa until they came back. And my husband went into my next door neighbour first. I believe he was broken hearted. He was crying in there and said, "How will I go in and tell her? How will I go in and tell her?" So anyway, he came in here and he said, "He's gone." And I couldn't believe it. I didn't know what to do. So they got the doctor for me. And he put me on, you know, the tablets, the Valium. It calmed me down. But I can't, even going to the funeral, what I used to do is I block my mind. Like, there's an awful lot of people there. It was the first teenager to be killed up here. And the chapel was absolutely packed. And you're kind of blank. You don't remember even what people are saying to you, like with the shock and everything like that. So anyway, I got through the funeral. I got through all that. But I used to take kind of weaknesses. I was taking weaknesses and blackouts and things like that. And one day I was very bad. I put the two wardrobes up to the bedroom door. I wouldn't let anyone in. I was going to end it all.
But anyway, you really felt like ending, did you?
I did, yeah.
Was that long after the funeral?
A week after. And the two wardrobes, the small one and the big one, I pushed them. And it was not my girl was roaring and crying. My husband tried to put his shoulder to the door, but he couldn't get in. And it was the next door neighbour, not that neighbour. My neighbours are very good. It was that neighbour there that came in. And she tried to coax me, "Come out, no, you won't." But I did. I said, "I'll end it all," I said.
And what were you going to do? Were you going to take an overdose,
yes,
or something?
I had the tablets, I had them. And I had them all up in my handbag. And I was saying, "I'll take it. What good is living after raising your child so far and after raising him so hard?" Like, to think that God took him. But you see, my husband used to say to me, he didn't take him. He didn't want him. God didn't want him. It was an accident, like. So then I'd say, well, he should be here with me. Like, but however, I pulled through that, and it was that was summer of 75, was a beautiful summer. It was the nicest summer we had. And I would try to go to the seaside with my three small ones and him. He took it. He had to stay to work, I think it was 6 weeks. And he kept saying, "I must go back to work. I couldn't stay in the house of my own. I wouldn't answer the door." That's the way the fright gets you. Even now, you tonight, I'd look through the Venetian blinds and I'd dread the police. Once I see the police, I know it's trouble coming to me. And it's always fatal. It's never like, "Oh, well," even if, yes, they were in a fight. It's always like, any time the police came to my door, my son was dead, or my husband was dead when he came. But I tried to pull myself together anyway for the children. I even used to go out, and I used to go out with him for a drink. I love a glass of stout. That's my favourite. I'd take 3 glasses of stout any time he brought me out. And even in the pub, all of a sudden, I'd be just crying. And he'd say, "Don't be crying, Peggy, because people looking at you, thinking that we're unhappy." And I'd say, "Well, I'm just crying." And another thing I cry for is when I see the fellas now that are my son's age and they're married and they've wives, and or even if they're never married, they're walking in and out, and he's gone. And I don't know how anyone gets over it. I say that, but I did. I got over it. As a matter of fact, I didn't go to mass either. I wouldn't go. Nobody passed any remark in the home, of course. They ignored me, kind of. They never said to me, "Are you going to go? Or did you go?" So in the end, then I kind of went back myself. Like, course, I said to myself, no, nobody's taking any notice of me, so I'll have to kind of pull myself together. Another thing too, I wouldn't wash my face. And when my kids come in from school and he'd come in from work, he'd ignore me. I'd have no dinner for him. But he'd never say, where's the dinner? Just like that. And then in the end, I knew I was hurting them as much as I was hurting myself. Well, there's Paul there. And I picked myself up and I started to go to the church again. And I got my hair cut and I went out at him and I wasn't as bad. I know, I really pulled myself together.
Was this now a long time afterwards that you started to pick up again?
No, it was about 3 months. I was really bad now for really 3 months. And another thing about it too, when the mamas would say, who are you crying over? What are you crying for now? That I kind of stopped it and tried to clean the house. The house and all was neglected now. And I wouldn't do anything, just sit and cry and smoke. So I pulled myself together and, oh yes, my husband brought me on a holiday. As a matter of fact, I didn't even want to go to. And I was gave him no thanks for kind of for doing it. And then I realised that he was suffering just as much as me. Like, I mean, he felt the hurt just as much as me. So then I realised and I picked myself up and I got the, like, cleaned the house. I used to even do a little bit of the garden and things like that. I got on terrific. And every day I was getting better. I went back to Mass and I prayed for him. And I thought it was terrific. And then that was 5 years ago.
While bereavement may affect people in different ways at different times, it normally follows a general pattern, as Dr. Dermot Walsh of the Medico-Social Research Board explains.
It is customary among some psychiatrists to talk about a fairly stereotyped grief pattern, a grief reaction, evolving over 6 months or even a year. The first stage is one of a numbing shock, an incomprehension as to the nature and the quality of what has happened, and also, of course, the implications. During this time, the individual may use denial, that's to say, he may, at one or another level or at many levels, indicate that he doesn't accept the death as having happened, despite all the objective evidence. He may give evidence of hostility. In other words, he's very cross with the circumstances, the other people involved in the death situation. By that I mean if it were a road accident, for example, the driver of the car or the other person involved in the accident. If it were a death during an operation, the doctors and nurses involved. So that hostility is sometimes apparent. Another phenomenon which is often seen is that of a state of quasi-automatism. That is to say, the individual seems to go around as if in a dream or if in a daze, performing routine functions in a very stereotypic fashion, almost without the intervention of consciousness. And then this situation, which may last for up to a week or thereabouts, will gradually pass off, and a frank expression of grief by tears, by obvious, overt trappings of mourning, poor sleep perhaps, and various psychosomatic disturbances which give rise to pains and aches and physical complaints. And that situation of the overt expression of grief may continue for weeks or even months. And then there is a phase when the emotional aspect of things tends gradually to be replaced by the cerebral, cognitive, intellectual realization of what it all means in terms of how am I going to survive and manage in the future without the support that I have just lost. This, of course, will continue the somatic distress, the physical distress of poor sleep. There will be perhaps physical pains and aches and general sense of not feeling well. There may be even feelings of guilt in relation to the deceased, things that I should have done and didn't during his lifetime, or more particularly things that I didn't do and I feel I might have done in the circumstances immediately surrounding his death. For example, why didn't I call a doctor sooner? That sort of thing. And then there may be other expressions which still derive from the mourning process, such as bad dreams in which the deceased is seen as he was or she was during lifetime. This coming back to the individual of the lost person during sleep, during dreams. And then there may be a preoccupation with the physical appurtenances of the deceased, looking at photographs, for example, looking at objects that that he or she was particularly attached to, a pair of slippers, something quite trivial like that. And then there is, of course, the grave visiting business, which plays a part in the overt expression of grief. That is to say, going frequently to the grave and crying. Of course, there'll be differences between the sexes. Men and women express their emotions differently, and we could expect that there'll be more overt grief expression among women than among men, who are expected in our culture to have a stiff upper lip.
The loss of a husband and the loss of a 20-year-old son in a comparatively short space of years may seem a heavy burden to bear, yet Margaret suffered another traumatic blow.
And I really used to think that God would never strike me down again. And this year, it was made the front of the Herald. It was in the front of the Herald, my husband. That was, it wasn't it, but it was the 9th of August. And that's the 9th of August. We always went on our holidays the second week in August. And that was the week for the last 4 years we were gone. That was the Saturday we used to go. And he went out to work. As a matter of fact, see, he was 2 years out of work.
This was your second husband?
Yes, second husband. He was 2 years out of work. No, through no fault of his own. He was made redundant. And he was, like, he was getting casual jobs, this, that and the other. And he went into this one. And he really thought it was terrific. And he was working his holidays for me. And he said to me, I didn't want him to go into work a Saturday morning. And I said to him, don't bother your head going in. You think we were hungry, which we weren't. I said, you're after doing enough. I said, we have enough money. Take the Saturday off. And he said, no, he's working Saturday and Sunday. He said, no, I won't. And I said to him, no, he says, I'll take it in next week off, Dana, and I'll bring you into town. And I'll bring you, get you a tea out, and I'll get the kids wherever we want to get. As a matter of fact, he was buying me a new suite. And I said to him, all right, that's satisfying. He said, I said, yes, that'll do. So he went in and he got up, he left the house. As a matter of fact, he was terrific. I just showed you, like, you don't know. He used to walk to work sometimes. He was that agile. Walk. And he'd be forced outside Melbourne Street Chapel, and if he was early, he'd got mass. So he took a pint and everything. He was no angel. But he left the house, and that was my last words to him. And at 10 to 12, we're at being up at the shopping centre. And it was a lovely day too. I only had one son with me, the youngest fella here. And we came down here. There was only him and I in the house. And he looked out the window. And he said, oh, Mammy, the police are at the door. And I said, well, the police are at the door. What would the police want of me? I do nothing. I did nothing on them. And neither did your daddy. And I know, I said, none of you are in trouble. And he was walking up. I said, you know, this is the wrong address. They're looking for somebody else. I was real cheeky going out, going saying, not here. And immediately he said the name. I knew, because it's an unusual name. And he said, your husband has met her in an accident. And I got all stuttery. And I nearly died. And I knew that he was unconscious, because he would have never sent the police here, because Mrs. Dow was a fawn. And I know that once I saw the police, I dread them. And I said, is he bad? And he said, you're to come immediately. So I wasn't able to, and I went over to Mrs. the guy next door, and her husband was there, and he ran through to the hospital, and the word came back that I was to come immediately. So my next door neighbour, which he was very good, I don't know what I'd do only for him, and my youngest, the other son, he was coming from work, he said, I'll go with you, Mummy. And I said, I needn't. And I really didn't think at the time it was bad. I said, oh no, I said, it'll be all right. I'll go myself. I'll see him. And anyway, we went to the hospital. And when I went into the hospital through the clinic doors, or to the outpatients, I saw a sister at the desk. And there was my son and my next door neighbour and me. And I knew. She must have known who I was, but as soon as she saw me, she just left everything and walked straight over to me. And I knew then. She said, "Oh, come on in here." She ushered me into a private room. And she said, "I have terrible news for you," said. "Your husband is dead." Well, I needn't tell you. I threw myself on the floor. He wanted to keep me in. I said, "If you keep me in, I'll jump out that window. I'll end it all." Now, this sister didn't even know what happened to me previous, you see. She thought that I was just a kind of an actress or something like that. She didn't know how I was at the hit me before. And my next door neighbour, he didn't even know what to do. He was crying. He just didn't know what to do. So she said, "We'll have to keep her in." I said, "If you're not keeping me in, I'll kill myself," I said. And she said, she may wrap me a lovely cup of tea. Now, they were very nice to me. They just couldn't do enough for me. And she gave me an injection to calm me down for 6 hours. So they kept me in for about an hour. And my neighbour and my son, my poor son, he was just broken hearted. He was in a corner just crying like a 2-year-old. He just couldn't believe that we're at the meeting it again. And we came home. And my next door neighbour brought me in here to their house. And that girl in there in the kitchen now, she just couldn't, you couldn't know what to say to me. Nobody knew what to say to me. As a matter of fact, my neighbours, they're only talking to me now because they said when they see me, they ran the other way. Because, do you know what, people just didn't know what to say to me. And you know what, I had 3 priests over me. Even the priests couldn't give me consolation. They just kept saying, "My sisters came up." They just didn't know what to say to me.
The problems facing the bereaved person depend on age, marital status, material circumstances, and many other factors, as well as the emotional disturbance.
The pattern I have described, of course, is a fairly general one, but I think one should make it clear that circumstances are very important. There's obviously a world of difference between a young wife whose husband is suddenly killed, leaving her with young children, on the one hand, and on the other, the death of an elderly spouse suffering from chronic, disabling, and perhaps painful illness, whose death is to himself and often to his wife or her husband a happy release. Clearly, the grief that is felt in the two situations is very different, both quantitatively and qualitatively. So I think one can't legislate for every situation when one is putting forward a descriptive scenario of bereavement and grief. In that sort of situation, where there is an elderly couple together and one who's been chronically ill for a long time, then the situation may actually be one of relief, because now the spouse can actually get a night's sleep and can physically enjoy a better quality of life than when he or she were up all night looking after the ill one, and perhaps in psychological anguish because of the pain of the ill spouse. Of course, when one is talking about the elderly, there are other difficulties. If a spouse is left alone who is elderly and who has lost a marriage partner of half a century, then the feeling of futility and worthlessness and going on may become apparent. And so the chances of suicide, for example, are high in that situation. There may be the feeling on the part of the surviving spouse that he or she would like to join he or she who has died in the next world, and suicide is an obvious way of doing that, or at least hastening it. I'm not saying that suicide is very frequent in these situations, but certainly such a person is at greater risk for suicide than the population as a whole.
Catherine was a young wife with a young husband and a young family. They left Ireland to seek a new life in a faraway country. A few months later, tragedy struck.
We were only 7 months away. I never my husband went out with some friends and didn't return. And very late at night, around 12 o'clock, I thought that something had happened. So I went to the station to report him not coming in. And while I was there, the policemen came in and reported an accident. And it turned out it was my husband had been in an accident, killed, along with another chap that was driving. My husband wasn't in his own car. He was a passenger, and the other chap driving, he was also killed. So that particular, I was in the police station at the time, and it was another friend, and I just couldn't believe it. I was dumbfounded, absolutely dumbfounded, and I just kept saying, what am I going to do, what am I going to do? So anyway, when I realised that all, he definitely was dead and the whole lot, then I, you know, some friends came to help me and the whole lot, and I didn't know whether I was going to get home fast or what. I was so shocked. I was just depending on other people to help me, you know. So I've been to a priest and the whole lot, an Irish priest, and he thought that the best thing for me to do would be, would I consider having my husband cremated and have the ashes brought home and buried in the normal way. When I thought about it then, I hadn't much of a choice, so I thought, well, it was the best thing to do for myself and the children in my life. And as time went on, I just bought a house and the whole lot and tried to settle in. But I can't accept my husband's debt at all. There's no way I can accept my husband's debt. I feel that I've been deprived of life, and I feel that the children are deprived, and, you know, there's so much involved when you haven't got your husband. And I think with children, you do need a man around the house. You need a man to give you a hand, and you need him, you know, with problems with the children, you've got to tell him. And I feel that children play on you, and it's a hard job when you're left with children, and then you worry about different things that you talk to your husband about, and loneliness above all. I think loneliness is the worst. I mean, people think because you have children that, you know, it's not great you have the children. I know it's great, all right, but at the same time, it's not the same as a man. There's no way. When I open my eyes every single morning, I think to myself, oh, another day of, you know, without Colin, without my husband. And I, you know, and the last thing at night, you know, I just say, gosh, at times I feel that I love to be surprised when I open the door, he's standing there. You know, I know that, I mean, that's a silly thing to say, I know, but I'm always hoping, I'm always wishing and hoping. This is how I feel, that it sort of hasn't gone out of my mind at all. You know that way? I feel it hasn't definitely left me yet, the shock. And another thing, I often think, you know, I just say, well, I suppose my time will come too, and I'll probably meet Colm then. But at the back of my mind, I just say, is it really, you know, is that really true? You know, I don't think much about those things at all. I suppose when you pray hard enough, I suppose you do realise, you know, but I haven't come round to that yet, you know. I really haven't now. I think about when we used to sit together watching television and arguing over different programmes that would be on, and I used to say to him, I wish you'd stop smoking that old pipe, some things like that, you know. And I just say, oh God, you know, if he only was sitting there now, I wouldn't say it, you know, these sort of things. And certain programmes on the television I watch that I would be on, I'd say, oh, Colm used to watch that.
It's 20 years now since Eileen's husband died, and although his death was not unexpected, she still has very vivid memories of her reactions at the time.
My doctor came down when he heard it, and he gave sleeping tablets to my brother, and he said, make her take them. Now, it was about 3 o'clock in the morning, I think, when I went to bed, and I took the sleeping tablet, and as I wasn't accustomed to them, it put me to sleep immediately. But I woke up at 8 o'clock in the morning, and it's very hard to describe the feeling of waking up in the morning and finding Dermot is gone. You will never hear his voice again. It was really terrible. And there was a feeling as if a cold, cold hand were gripping on my heart, inside my chest, and that I couldn't get rid of it. It was a terrible thing. I think the following morning, when you wake up to stark reality, you nearly die. You would like to be dead. So then, of course, the funeral and crowds of people came. I didn't have house private. But then after everybody had gone, somebody used to be in every night, and I'd have a nightcap with them, and that did make me nice and drowsy, and I fell asleep. But then the first night I was alone, there was a bottle of whiskey in the kitchen. And I went to the kitchen, and I said, I'll have a nightcap now that'll make me go to sleep. The children, of course, were very young, and they were put to bed early. And I went to the kitchen. I stood at the kitchen door, and I said, no, you don't. Don't drink it on your own. You mustn't. I was dying for a drink now, dying for it. But I turned back, and I twisted, and I turned in the bed until 3 a.m, and several times I said, I'll get up, and I'll get myself a hot whiskey. But I didn't. And I think it saved me. Because really, if I had gone in that time, I think I would have gone on the bottle.
Jim was a young man working in America when he got news of his father's death.
I was a teacher out there, and there were a number of us teachers and a number of the parents putting on a play called Goldilocks. And I happened to be all dressed up and ready to go on stage to play the part of Goldilocks. And there was a telephone call from me from Ireland, and I said, well, could I not wait till the play was over? Could they not call me back then? Or if it's that bad, I could always call them back myself. And they said, no, it's very important. You better get over there now. So I went over, and it was my brother on the phone, and he told me the bad news. It came as a shock. I was sort of speechless for a few minutes, and then I said, well, just leave me to think it out, and I'll call you back in a while.
Did it take you long then to get over the initial shock?
It took me quite a while. But particularly because I wasn't working. I felt if I was working and doing something, my mind wouldn't have been as preoccupied with the thought of not seeing my father alive anymore. The fact that I was at home and thinking about it and that wasn't concentrating on other things, that wasn't a help. But when I got back to work, I sort of put it out of my mind, even though I still cared, it helped to be back at work. And it was a matter of, say, about 2-3 weeks after the funeral that I was back at work again. And again, I was away. I had to go back to Canada. I was away from home.
But do you find now that his memory has receded somewhat in your mind, or are there times, say, every day or every week that you still think of him and you have, well, slight pangs of grief still?
Yeah, I wouldn't say I have pangs of grief. Places I go to, or people I talk to, we often, or even when I go to visit my own brothers, we often talk about him and talk about times past, when I go down to visit the family, people talk about him a lot, and I don't have any grief at that time. I feel proud more than anything else.
It's not easy to determine which loss is the greatest, the death of a husband, wife, father, mother, child, or some other loved one, because so much depends on the circumstances and the particular relationship at the time of bereavement. But Margaret, who lost two husbands and a son, is definite about her feelings.
He's part of you. I mean, your husband is your best friend you have, I'll say that, or vice versa. He's your mate. But your child is part of you. And that's why people cry too over children that they're only maybe 2 or 3 hours in your arms, but they're still part of you. And that's why your child is the worst. It's the hardest to bear. I think so, anyway.
And when you're thinking of the three losses still after this space of time, it's the son that gives you the greatest feeling of grief.
Yes. He gives me worse grief than any of the rest of them, because he was so young too, youth. He wasn't... He wasn't sick. Even I said, when the priest was saying to me, I said, if the priest, if even if he was sick and was or even if he was injured, and the doctors in the hospital say, well, he only has 3 or 4 days. But you see, I never even had time to talk to my son. Only when he said bye to me at 6:30. And that's the terrible thing. And it's the irony of it. And of course, they wouldn't let me look at him. They said there was nothing wrong with him, but I don't believe that. But they wouldn't let me into the...
Well, he was knocked down by a car crossing the road.
Crossing the road, yes. And he was, I think it was his head injury. That's what's on the death certificate. It was his head that got it. Otherwise, they said there was nothing wrong with him. But now I don't believe that, because they wouldn't let me look at him. They wouldn't let me look at my husband either. I never saw them, because I don't know why. Why do people do that?
Funeral director Frank Jennings has seen the many facets of bereavement over a long period, yet he still finds it difficult to determine the extent of grief caused by any particular death.
I don't really know. You see, people are composed of so many things. We're all individuals. Some of us, as you said to me earlier, just don't seem to be able to cope at all. Others seem a little less emotional. So to some people, the death of a close relative is something they can carry on with, that they can manage. To others, it's a shattering of everything they knew, and it affects them so terribly that it's quite frightening. Certainly a child's death is more sentimental, but you know, I think people tend to get over a child's death because the child hasn't become a part of their living so much. It hasn't become a breadwinner or somebody they totally depended on. It's somebody they certainly loved, but they tend to place that sort of an emotion in a glass case and remember it for the rest of their lives. But the death of a husband or a wife, I would think, especially in an accident where the whole reality of it only comes in by degrees, I think can be the worst thing of the whole lot.
You are in daily contact with bereavement and with grief. Does that make it any easier for you? Do you feel that you could cope quite easily when a bereavement would come your way?
No, I don't think so at all. I certainly would know what to do, but how I'd do it would be a different thing altogether. You see, when you've dealt with so many people over a period... By the way, I'm 40 years here next April, and over there I've seen thousands and thousands of people, and average things happen. There's the loss of a husband or a wife, and as I mentioned to you, the dreadful sense of nowhere to go and nothing in the future for you. I know this is going to happen to me. I know either I'm going to die and my wife will be left, or she's going to die and I'll be left. And, you know, they talk about people as they get older, that their children tend to put them in nursing homes or in hospitals because there's no room for them. This is quite true. So possibly this is going to happen to me. So it doesn't make it easier. It's not that I'm upset about it, but I know the facts. And whereas I don't think it's a good idea that other people should be aware of these facts. There are too many imponderables. But taking an average, I can see that these things are very likely to happen to me.
Now, you have seen death very, very often. Are you scared of death yourself?
Absolutely. I'm talking about the physical side of death. I know how it affects other people. And whether it's my death or somebody in my family, I know from their experience how I'm going to feel. So yes, I am. I'm quite frightened of it.
While there's life, there's hope, and the passage of time alleviates many of the more painful pangs of grief, even for distressed people like Margaret.
I'm left again, just the same, but worse off, is that right? I'm older, and there's not much fight in me left. I mean, the fight has nearly gone out of me. I really have no social life yet, anyway, but I intend to do something about it. I will now, when I get a little bit better. Like, I'll say, now, please God, after Christmas, I'm going to try and get a little bit of a job. Try and get me out of myself. Because, see, you must keep going. See, you must stand up and be counted.